Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. For 24 years, today's guest, Mustafa Ali, worked at the Environmental Protection Agency. He helped found the EPA's Environmental Justice Office back in 1992. He resigned from his post last March after the White House announced plans to dismantle the Environmental Justice Program and a number of grant programs designed to assist low-income communities. Over the past 24 years, Mustafa Ali has worked with hundreds of communities of color, low-income communities, and indigenous populations living with toxic levels of air pollution, crumbling or non-existent water and sewer infrastructure, lead in their drinking water, and hazardous waste sites. The country's most vulnerable communities are disproportionately impacted by the daily assault on the environment, and it is drastically affecting their health. On today's Your Call, we are marking Martin Luther King Jr. Day by talking about the connections between environmental and social justice. What can be done to truly tackle these issues at a time when the EPA's priorities are shifting to protect the interests of oil, gas, and major polluters? Mustafa Ali is now Senior Vice President of Climate, Environmental Justice, and Community Revitalization at the Hip Hop Caucus. He is founding member of the EPA's Office of Environmental Justice, and he joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Hi, Mustafa. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you. We have been wanting to get you on the show since you resigned last March. And I'm glad it actually took a while for us to bring you on, because you've had a lot of time to reflect on the time that you spent at the EPA and, unfortunately, to watch what is happening inside of the EPA. Reuters just posted an article about Trump's EPA plans to replace Obama-era climate water regulations. I mean, the list is so long. So on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, how are you reflecting on specifically environmental justice?
Well, you know, Dr. King, for us, gave us sort of a great template for understanding that these issues that are so pressing, that have such huge impacts in the lives of folks across our country, but especially our most vulnerable community, that it is truly a marathon and not a sprint, that we have to continually be engaged in the process to make change happen, that we have to hold ourselves and others accountable, and that we have to, through nonviolent ways, make sure that we are continuing to engage in a process and to educate others about what's happening, but also about the change that is possible. So I'm still optimistic, but I know that there's still a lot of work to do.
What do you think about what is coming out of the EPA? Inside Climate News has a piece, Beyond Standing Rock, Environmental Justice Suffered Setbacks. You know, things like the EPA suspending new chemical plant safety rules, the administration halted a mountaintop mining health risk study. I mean, the list is just very long. How are you making sense of all of these rollbacks?
Well, I think it's very egregious. I think it is also very short-sighted. And I think that it shows that there is a lack of connection between our current administration. And I was blessed to work for five administrations, including this last one, which was very, very short. And this is the first time I've ever seen an administration that is so disconnected for what is truly happening on the ground and what folks are asking for. I have been blessed to work with thousands of communities, actually, and I have never yet once in all of those communities, from communities in Appalachia to communities in the Rust Belt to communities along the Gulf Coast, ever heard one of them say that they would like to see less enforcement, less regulations happening in their communities, because in many, many instances, these communities have been asking for stronger enforcement because they have not yet received the same level of protection. And when you don't have those regulations in place, when you don't have enforcement happening, then there's no way that these communities can ever fully be protected. So this administration, unfortunately, and I hope that they will evolve, but I have each day been losing more and more faith in that happening, that they will spend time with real people. As I've often said, as I travel around the country, spend some time with Mrs. Ramirez in her kitchen. hearing about some of the things that are going on when she looks out of her front door, or spend some time with Mr. Johnson on his back porch as he talks to you about the changes that he's seen in his communities and the impacts that have been happening for some time now. And then ask yourself, are the actions that you are moving forward on going to be more protective of these types of communities, or are they going to place them in greater harm? And unfortunately, more folks will get sick and more folks will lose their lives.
You had a very important position at the EPA. You helped found the agency's Environmental Justice Office in 1992. And when you stepped down, I'm guessing that a lot of people didn't know that there was an Environmental Justice Office within the EPA. And in a number of interviews, you say that you helped found it, but it really was created by grassroots organizations. Can you tell us about how it got started?
Oh, without a doubt. And I'm so glad you asked that question. Sometimes people have the misconception that the Office of Environmental Equity, which became the Office of Environmental Justice, came about because of some great thinking, federal employees or other folks in the government, and that would be a false narrative. It actually came out of a set of recommendations. In the late 80s, there was the Michigan Working Group, and folks got together, were a number of stakeholders who were a part of that. And out of some previous actions, they began to have folks coming together. They came up with a set of recommendations based upon some of the things that they saw going on. And then in 1991 was the first People of Color Summit focused on environmental justice, which had communities from across our country and from other countries coming together to talk about some of the impacts that were happening. And people began to connect the dots. And through these two sort of hallmark events, those recommendations began to take root in the Environmental Protection Agency. And I'd like to give credit to former Administrator William Riley, who was under the first Bush administration, who was the one who received those recommendations. And through a lot of negotiation, a lot of push and pull, residents and stakeholders really pushing the agency, they began then to develop the first Office of Environmental Equity. And it was just a small office. There were seven of us when we first got it started. And I was blessed that I was right there a little bit before that as an intern. So most folks don't know that I actually started off as a student and had the opportunity to actually meet and engage with a number of the sort of hallmark leaders that we now honor. And going back to your earlier question, yes, many folks did not know in the beginning, of course, that there was an issue around environmental equity, which became environmental justice. And one of our goals over the time that I was at the Environmental Protection Agency was to try to create some intersection points, but also to educate folks around the country about this issue in conjunction, in collaboration with the environmental justice leaders who had been doing the work even far longer. So the history really is wedded in the community. It's wedded in stakeholders and their contribution and dedication to these issues of never giving up, which is very, very connected to Dr. King also. And just for the record, many of the folks who came out of the civil rights movement and some of the other social justice movements, from the Chicano movement, from the AIM movement, from the civil rights movement, all were a part of the early leaders in the environmental equity / justice movement.
How did the mission of this division change over time?
It evolved. The beauty of being there in the beginning, and Dr. Clarice Gaylord, who was leading us at that time, was one of making sure that we were always anchored in what communities were asking for. Communities did not have an intersection point at that time in the federal government. And our goal was to hear what they were asking for, take those recommendations along with other stakeholder recommendations, and begin to try and figure out ways of making those things happen. So when you look at some of the most successful programs and actions that have come out of the Environmental Protection Agency in relationship to environmental justice and a number of other programs, and then actually evolving and integrating into other federal agencies and departments. Those came from those communities. Those came from having the space and building the relationships to be able to try things. And if it worked, that was great. And if it didn't, we would all come back together and try and figure out what was missing, what was needed, and then try again. And that was the beauty of being a young person coming up, that, you know, I had the opportunity to be surrounded by folks who weren't afraid to try, who weren't afraid to be innovative, and who weren't afraid to allow the voice of communities to be a leader in the process. And that was some of the work in the early days. When you look at things like the Environmental Justice Small Grants Program, which has now reached probably over 1,600 communities across the country, that came out of those recommendations. That came out of those sets of conversations with communities and leaders saying, what is it that's needed that will help you to be able to move forward on this journey toward environmental justice? When you look at the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council, a very innovative idea at the time, because we knew that we needed to bring business and industry to the table. We knew that we needed to have the states and local government. We knew that we needed to have tribal representation and grassroots representation. So the NEJAC, the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council, is actually a FACA. Now, for most folks who don't work in a government, they're like, well, what is a FACA? It's a federal advisory committee. It's an opportunity for these different stakeholders to come together and to provide advice and recommendation to the administrator. Of course, you have to have an administrator, one, who's interested in receiving those recommendations and then is willing to act upon them and then to be transparent in that process. That is a part of that evolution that I talk about in the early days of these new things being created to help to build the foundation for making change inside of communities.
As you said, you have worked with thousands of communities of color, low-income communities, and indigenous populations living with so many things, toxic levels of air pollution, lead in their drinking water. Can you talk about how these communities interact with the EPA, at least when you were there, and then give us a couple of examples of how their voices actually affected policies.
Sure. No, again, a very, very excellent question. You know, the interaction really depends. Some folks may know that there are 10 regions that represent our country, and you know, it's broken up that way. So we have environmental justice teams or individuals across the country in those regions, and then also working with those states that have environmental justice programs or at least an interest in environmental justice. So communities have a number of different intersection points. They can work with the regions, and I believe in something called real talk. So for some regions, they've done a much better job in engaging and honoring the voice of communities. And then there have been others that have had some challenges that haven't evolved as quickly as communities probably would like. And, you know, one of the measuring sticks that I've always used for my own work is that if communities were satisfied, if communities felt that my interaction or our interaction was of value, then we were moving in the right direction. But if they didn't, then that meant that there was some work that still needed to happen or some changes that needed to happen. So communities had and continue, hopefully, to have the opportunity to engage with folks on the regional level. But also, if they couldn't find sort of the success that they were looking for, then they could always also engage with the headquarters office. Now, when we first got started, you know, all of the regions, of course, did not have EJ representation, and that was something also that had to happen over time. But those are some of the ways that folks were able to engage, either through the headquarters office, through the hotline, through us actually being out there. The Office of Environmental Equity and the Office of Environmental Justice was a little bit different because, especially in the early days, we were actually out there, where in many offices in a headquarters level, it's more the regional folks who are the only ones who are out there. But ours was always different in the sense that we were founded on the fact that you can't do policy, that you can't do this work if you're not actually out there with the people, hearing from them what's going on. One of the concerns that currently is happening is that with the shrinking budgets and, you know, rolling back of staff and losing of staff positions, that this tradition, which has been instrumental for the government as a whole, and hopefully I'll have a chance to talk a little bit about that, will be lost. That you will no longer have that connection, which is so, so tough to get. Because you have to remember, when we're talking about indigenous communities, as an example, there have been a litany of broken promises over the years. So to build relationships of trust takes time, it takes commitment, and it takes honor in that space. And it's the same thing with other communities of color, and it takes the same thing with communities where I come from in Appalachia, where you, in many instances, you don't see a whole lot of folks from the federal family. And in some instances, there has at least been the perception of not a good relationship there. The Office of Environmental Justice and environmental justice work, one of the central cores was in building that trust. And you really take a very, very strong position of loosening that when you don't have the ability to spend the time and to be honest and transparent with folks. I'll stop there for a second.
On today's Your Call, we are marking Martin Luther King Jr. Day by speaking with Mustafa Ali. He started at the EPA when he was a student. He was there for 24 years, and he worked with thousands of communities across the country. He helped found the EPA's Environmental Justice Office with grassroots organizations back in 1992. He resigned from his post last March, after the White House announced plans to dismantle the Environmental Justice Program and also a number of grants that did so much to help low-income communities across the country. If you have any questions for Mustafa about the work he did at the EPA, what it's like working there under many administrations, I mean, a lot of people have left since Mustafa has left. So many regulations have been rolled back very, very quickly. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And then when you reflect on where we are right now, I was just listening to a Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speech today and then thinking about where we are today. And you just take a deep breath. I mean, he was talking about registering African Americans to vote, and then you look at voter suppression. So when you look at environmental justice specifically and its connections to social justice, we'd love to hear your comments and just what you're thinking today. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Mustafa, you sent a resignation letter to Scott Pruitt when you resigned last March. And something really struck me. You wrote about grants that are given to communities by the EPA, and you write about ReGenesis. It's a project in Spartanburg, South Carolina, where a community leveraged a $25,000 environmental justice small grant into millions of dollars in positive local changes, creating jobs and improving their environments through various partnerships. We can talk specifically about that, but just the fact that a community can do so much with $25,000 really struck me. I mean, when you think about, for example, the military budget of this country and what it costs for one weapon and what you're able to do with a tiny amount of money. Can you talk about that?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's amazing. When you look at environmental justice, and, you know, there's a couple of different ways of looking at that. So first of all, let me talk about these incredible organizations and networks that exist, just in case some of the listeners are not aware. So from the early days, folks understood as they began to talk with each other that, one, there needed to be a network of individuals. So these networks began to develop. And inside of these networks are hundreds and hundreds of communities and organizations that exist. And when you look at what some of these organizations are able to, to do, sometimes working with $50,000 or $100,000 a year budget, and sometimes if folks got up to $100,000, then, you know, they felt that they were in the big time now. And then you sort of take a look at some of our larger green organizations, and I'm friends and sit on boards with many of these folks who have these million-dollar, hundreds of million-dollar budgets. It just helps to further amaze me with the creativity that exists in organizations like UpRose in Brooklyn or WEAC, which is in Harlem, New York, or the folks with Derek Evans in Turkey Creek, Mississippi. or APEN on the West Coast, or the former Southwest Network for Economic and Environmental Justice that Richard Moore used to run and now runs Los Andinos Institute. I say this as an example of these small amounts of money and the incredible work that folks are able to do to educate their communities, to help them to better engage, with folks who are making decisions around policy, helping folks to understand how to monitor their air and water quality. So many different examples of how folks have been able to utilize just those small amounts of dollars for their baseline budgets. If we flip the coin over and then begin to look at, some of the results of programs like the Environmental Justice Small Grants Program, and you mentioned the Regenesis Project, of how they were able to bring together, over 140 partners and to develop what I often call authentic collaborative partnerships, mm-hmm. ones where there is a balance of power, one where the voice of communities can continue to be a driver in the process, one that's able to address not only the environmental issues that are happening inside of communities, but also the education issues, the housing-related issues, transportation issues, the creation of jobs, and addressing a number of other issues also inside of the community. That is what happens when we, one, have that seed money that's available for folks who are very, very focused and very, very serious about making change inside their communities, who are looking for an opportunity to bring others into that process, who want to be authentic partners in that process, and who also want to be a part of a vision of change. Sometimes when folks hear about the environmental injustices that are happening, like the injustices that happened in Flint, Michigan, the injustices that have happened at Standing Rock, the injustices that have happened in East Chicago, and I could go on and on, they think that that's what environmental justice is. That is a part of that paradigm. When you sit down and have a conversation with the leaders in the environmental justice movement, those folks who are on the ground in communities, the ultimate goal is to be able to revitalize their communities, for their communities to have the same benefits that many of the other communities across our country are blessed to have. And that's why those grants are so important, is because they are helping to move folks, helping them to position themselves, helping them to build the foundation that's necessary for us to move from what I often call from surviving to thriving.
In your letter to Scott Pruitt, you write that small grants have assisted over 1,400 communities. And one of the reasons why you resigned, in addition to the White House saying that they were going to get rid of the environmental justice program, they also said that they were going to dismantle the grant program. Do you have any updates on that?
Yes. So we are blessed. And this is the power of the voice of people. And when you place a spotlight on injustices, how that spotlight can then move people toward truth, move people toward doing the right thing. Let's say it that way. So the grant program is still in existence. We'll have to see with the upcoming budget conversations and decisions that will be made. If we can continue to, for it to be in its existence. But as far as I know, and of course, I'm still no longer in the agency, it's still in place. But just being in place without funding, leaves a huge gap in the process. But what it also has done, the Environmental Justice Small Grants Program also helped to move a paradigm to a different way of thinking. So there were a number of other grant programs that came out not only inside the Environmental Protection Agency or in the Office of Environmental Justice realm, but across the agency and into other agencies who saw the success that was happening from it. CDC began to move forward. HHS began to move forward. HUD began to think more critically about the type of criteria that they needed to have in their existing grant programs to better and be more inclusive of vulnerable communities. When you look at some of the work inside of transportation, in the early days we sat down with them, and when you look at Tiger Grants and some of the other ones, you begin to hear or see reflections of environmental justice in the criteria, which then leads to the decision making and where those resources go and how they can be leveraged. Because one of the things we were always trying to do and why it's so important to have this program, not only at the Environmental Protection Agency, but in other places, is that when these communities begin to get these small grants and show that they have the ability and wherewithal to utilize a federal grant, then it opens the doors to other possibilities, to other funding streams, and then they can leverage that into real change. When you look at the Regenesis Project, that's one of the things that happened. After they were able to get some of these smaller types of grants, they were able to then leverage into some of the other programs that existed, not only in EPA, but in HUD, in HUD and transportation and a few other places. And that's what this is about. It's about giving power back to communities, allowing them to utilize that power for their vision and the change that needs to happen.
On today's Your Call, we are marking Martin Luther King Jr. Day by speaking about environmental justice with Mustafa Ali. He worked at the EPA for 24 years. He started there when he was a student. And in 1992, he worked with grassroots organizations to help found the EPA's Environmental Justice Office. He decided to resign from his post last March after the White House announced plans to dismantle that office and a number of grants that assist low-income communities. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will be joined in studio by Daniel Ellsberg. He'll be talking about his new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. He's also author of Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. If you get a chance, there's a great documentary about Daniel Ellsberg. Maybe watch it tonight and then join us tomorrow. Wednesday, we'll be talking with people who are part of the resistance. We'll be talking about some victories. And then later in the show, we'll be speaking with Greg Boyle, who founded the amazing organization Homeboy Industries down in L.A. Their motto is nothing stops a bullet like a job. It's a really amazing organization. If you have any guest ideas or a show idea, you can drop us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's show with Mustafa Ali, he is now Senior VP of Climate, Environmental Justice, and Community Revitalization at the Hip Hop Caucus. In 92, he helped found the EPA's Environmental Justice Office with community groups. He worked there for 24 years, started as a student, decided to leave last March after the White House announced plans to dismantle the program. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Mustafa, you talked about the history of the Office of Environmental Justice at the EPA. When you look back at the history of environmental justice, the whole movement, what really stands out for you?
That's excellent. I mean, there are so many things. Of course, you know, many folks talk about the flashpoint, which was in Warren County, North Carolina, and the commitment and dedication of folks. So in Warren County, folks had made a decision to place some cancer-causing chemicals in a landfill there. And the folks, you know, began to protest and say no. And partly because there was a study that was done and showed that their community was not the best location for this waste that they wanted to place in the landfill. So folks were literally willing to lay down in the streets to stop the trucks from coming into their community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, that showing that level of commitment, willing to place your life on the line, if you will, not only for yourself, but for your community and for the generations to come, you know, that is a powerful sort of sign of what we need to do sometimes to, you know, to sort of stand up and push back against injustice. But, you know, you can actually go back to when folks first came to this country, you know, for African slaves who came and were placed on plantations. You will see that they were placed in the most undesirable parts of the plantation, given the most undesirable foods, which could be considered food justice related issues. If you look at Chinese workers who came to our country and worked on our railroads, they were given the most dangerous jobs and once again also placed off to the side in many of the small towns and shanty sort of villages that were, you know, around some of the railroad development. You, of course, can look at our Native American brothers and sisters who were removed from their traditional lands and placed once again in the most undesirable locations. And even though they still were able to move forward, these are, for me, environmental injustices. So we can go back to, you know, the early days of our country, or we can look at some of those that are not that far away, like Warren County, North Carolina, in the late 70s, early 80s, which was a driver for this process. But then you can actually come forward. And for many folks who are newer to the work in this space, when I say Flint, Michigan, it automatically, you know, light bulbs go off for folks. And they understand how these injustices can play out, and not just in the immediate sense, but how these decisions that are being made by others on top of others' lives can actually have long, long generational effects. If you look at the young people, the babies and the other young students who are impacted by being exposed to lead, once you are exposed to it, those neurological problems will follow you throughout your life. And the price that we have to pay through healthcare, and if we do education right, if we could take those dollars and do it right in the beginning and not expose folks to these types of things, it actually has a stronger payoff if we did things correctly. So you can look all the way back to the beginning of our country, or you can look here in the not-so-distant past. And unfortunately, and I hope folks pay attention to this, you know, the egregious actions that happened in Flint, Michigan are just a snapshot. Mm-hmm. There are over 3,000 other locations, other communities around our country that have higher levels of lead in them than the terrible disaster that happened in Flint, Michigan. And that's why you have to have a strong Environmental Protection Agency, and that agency and other agencies need to be connected to communities. And we should never expect communities to have to come to us. We should actually be out there with them.
To that point, in February, the Huffington Post had a piece: more than 1,700 residents of Flint, Michigan have filed a class action lawsuit against the EPA, accusing officials of negligent mismanagement of the city's drinking water crisis. The suit accuses the EPA of a critical failure to supervise local officials who allowed very high levels of toxic lead to leach into the city's drinking water, and it comes amid Trump's plans to gut the budget at the already overwhelmed agency. You were at the EPA when all of this happened. What was it like to work there at this time? I mean, you talk about the different regions. Some regions actually take initiative, some don't. What was it like to be involved at that time?
It was a very interesting time. As you can imagine, there were a number of issues that were going on, not just in Flint, but of course, Flint was a very, very significant one. And, you know, there was a lot of sort of evaluation of what had happened, what was going on, and what we needed to do. Administrator McCarthy at that time was very, very focused on how do we make sure that we are fixing and working with the right folks and making sure that the state was doing what it was supposed to have been doing, and unfortunately had not been living up to that. So there was sort of a focus on let's make sure that we get in there, that we make sure that the water quality gets back up to the level that's necessary, and that we are making the investments inside of this community that are necessary. One of the things that I personally did was I went back and asked. So we had a hotline that hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of communities had utilized over the years. So I had my folks take a look and see if anyone had ever called in on the hotline. And I was surprised, you know, once I had heard, you know, what was happening there, that no one had ever called in on that. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that we did was and I had mentioned the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council, you know, folks went back and took a look at, we have a public comment period. So folks would travel around the country, and the meetings would travel in different locations, and lots of times folks would come and share with the NEJAC, and then the NEJAC would make recommendations to the agency. And no one had done that either, had utilized those processes. So I wanted to make sure that from sort of my standpoint, that if anyone had engaged with us, what happened in that process? And we hadn't had anybody who had engaged with us there. So, you know, that was an interesting time because the state had some responsibilities that they did not live up to, had made some decisions. And so folks were just very, very focused on helping to get the water quality back up. One of the things that we did on the environmental justice side was to make sure that we were getting some of our types of folks down on the ground to make sure that the community's voice would be heard, that there was translation where it needed to be. And so we sort of went out to the agency for all the different folks who had experience in environmental justice. We created something called the Environmental Justice Ambassadors, and we had them to go over to Flint, Michigan, to actually be embedded there with the response that was going on, to engage with communities, to help folks who sometimes don't have the skill sets to be able to, you know, properly flow with communities, to have people who we knew how to do that. So we had folks with a minimum of 10 years of experience with to folks all the way up with over 30 plus years of experience in environmental justice who were there. So those were some of the things that I know that I was a part of.
Where are we today? I'm reading from MichiganMLive.com, and according to this piece that just came out, lead levels dropped slightly in Flint homes tested during the second half of 2017. A state official announced the news and said the city's water quality is restored. Now, if I lived there, I wouldn't trust any official. So what are you, I mean, you visited Flint after you left your job at the EPA, but do you have any updates on what's happening? Are people still drinking bottled water?
There are people still drinking bottled water. And you may remember, I think it was maybe a month ago now, that there was a big conversation because they were thinking about taking the bottled water away. So there had been hubs that were there, places that folks could go and pick up bottled water. Because folks at that time still didn't have the confidence in the water system. Now, I hope that folks will realize that for people to get the confidence back in that drinking water system is going to take time. And if you understand that that's going to take time, then our commitment in that space has to be continual until folks feel comfortable with that, because the trust was broken. And sometimes sort of government paradigms, if you will, have this sort of flow of this will happen, then that will happen, then this will happen. And that's not the way human nature works. It's almost like when you're in a relationship with someone, and when that trust has been damaged or broken, then it's going to take a while to be able to repair that. And the way that you repair that is being honest, being consistent, and being present in that process. So that's what I see. So in my conversations with folks and when I've been back, there are folks who still have some real concerns in that space. You may also remember that I think it was about 9 months ago now, maybe a little less than that, there was a study that also came out that talked about the miscarriages that women were having there. So, you know, there are a number of different types of dynamics that are still in people's minds and people's bodies are still dealing with. So we have to be respectful of that and understand that these concerns are still going on and that folks still have concerns around the environmental and public health related challenges in that space.
And a number of community activists criticized the EPA under the Obama administration for not taking action quickly enough. I mean, to so many, you know, people outside, it's like, wait a minute, the wealthiest country on earth, and this is happening, and they can't deal with this. People are still drinking bottled water. From your vantage point, what do you think the EPA could have done differently?
Playing armchair quarterback, I think that one of the things that every administration that I have worked for, and there have been some great ones, and then there were some that, you know, were just not as focused, you know, could always invest more in vulnerable communities. And when I say invest, I'm talking about making sure that there's enough staff to be out there across the country, making sure that our inspectors have the training that's necessary in engaging with our most vulnerable communities, and then making sure that we are prioritizing the needs of those communities and having individuals being able to be out there. So I think that all of the administrations could have done a better job, even though there were some that did better than others. And making sure that those intersection points are there, is extremely important. And also making sure that we are funding those organizations that are on the ground, which in many, many instances are the ones who would be the first to hear about something. And for them to have the confidence and have the ability to be able to actively engage with whatever administration that might be. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so nervous about this administration, is because I just don't see that. Mm-hmm. Actually, when I talk to folks around the country, maybe folks had worked with for 20 or 30 years, they've just completely lost confidence in being able to see any type of actions from our newest administration. But let me be clear, every administration has a responsibility to make sure that folks aren't feeling that way.
What do you think will happen with the EPA? Scott Pruitt has admitted that he wanted to get rid of the EPA. Just some recent news, former Wisconsin regulator Kathy Stepp was named as head of the EPA's regional office in Chicago, and she got a lot of praise from business groups. She's a former home builder with no scientific background. I mean, so many people being appointed are climate deniers. They come from the industry. What are your thoughts about what ultimately will happen with the EPA under this administration?
Well, the EPA is built upon strong science and the law. And the beauty of that is that those two sort of foundational elements are like mountains. And it's tough to break those down, but you can weaken them. And under a one-term administration, I think that many of those, those foundational elements can continue to exist, although they won't be as effective. But, this is not just about this administration. And when folks around the country ask what they can do, I often tell them that you can make sure that you are engaging with your congressional representative and educating them about what your expectations are. I never tell anyone who to vote for. But you should be sharing with them, because there are checks and balances in our government. That's why we have three branches of the government. And you should let folks know what your expectations are. And if someone can't meet your expectations, that you will find somebody else to fill that job. And what you've seen is that even though there have been some outlandish proposals, and there have been, some negative movements, but many of those to date have been checked. Because we have these different branches of government and that folks understand that if they move too far, that, that folks will definitely be letting them know about that. So folks have the opportunity and they have the power to get engaged in this process and to hold people accountable. So that's one of the things. What you will see is that capacity inside of the Environmental Protection Agency will continue to be whittled away. Those folks have been doing the work for generations. Those folks who are willing to be innovative, those folks who are willing to go above and beyond, you're going to lose some of that. You're going to lose confidence from some communities around the country. You're going to see, if folks continue to move forward around climate-related issues, you're going to see stronger storms happening, because if we were moving in a position of rolling back the Clean Power Plan, moving back against some of these air-related protections that are in place or weakening them, then, you're going to have stronger storms, you're going to have more pollution, you're going to have a number of different things that will happen in that space. But luckily, folks have woke up. I often share with folks around the country that, just about a year ago now, no one thought that 1 million women would come together, but they did. And not only did they come together, but they also shared with the country what their expectations were, but they took those expectations back to their communities and began to get engaged in the civic process, began to identify folks who they felt would be representative of them. And you're now seeing some of that playing out. You never thought that you would see scientists come out of their labs and march, but not only march, but then also give back to communities. I'm working with a number of scientists who are, you know, engaging with, in a collaborative way, vulnerable communities. So seeing scientists get so engaged, making sure that their voices are heard, is another example of how folks are pushing back against the federal family, an administration leading the federal family who's out of touch. And you see that as you go through and look at a number of different things that are going on.
Mustafa Ali is Senior VP at the Hip Hop Caucus, and he left the EPA in March after 24 years. We don't have much time, Mustafa, but I want to ask you a question about Standing Rock. I really appreciate that in your resignation letter to Scott Pruitt, you mention Indigenous communities. I noticed that in all of your interviews, you also talk about Indigenous communities, and I think everyone needs to do a better job of including Indigenous communities in all of these conversations because they're too often missing. And you were at the EPA when Standing Rock happened and when we saw the violent crackdown. Now, The Intercept revealed last year that a mercenary firm known as Tiger Swan targeted the movement opposed to the Dakota Access Pipeline with military-style counterterrorism measures. And they worked with all levels of government. Tiger Swan internal communications were calling water protectors jihadist fighters. And I just wondered, you know, there's good people in government, good people at the EPA like you. What was your response when you saw these brutal crackdowns?
I've always spoke out against injustice wherever it was. You know, people always said I was a little tiny bit different. I didn't think so. And, you know, we're supposed to stand up when we see injustice happening. And what you saw happening in Standing Rock and in other locations that Indigenous folks have been fighting is something that you will also see in communities with other environmental justice concerns, where when communities would stand up, they would have these labels placed upon them so that folks would have a false narrative, so that folks would not want to get engaged in, you know, and being supportive. So that's one of the reasons that we have to make sure that when people are doing these types of things, that we continue to push back and not let that type of thing take root. You know, Dr. King once said, you know, there comes a time when we must take a position that is either neither safe nor politic nor popular, but he or she must do it because it's the right thing to do. And that's sort of the mantra that I was raised with in the environmental justice movement. And, you know, those brothers and sisters at Standing Rock and all the folks who came there and continue to engage in that process understand that they're, you know, you have to stand up against these types of injustices. And, you know, that's what we're founded on. The Indigenous Environmental Network that Tom Goldtooth leads, and Dallas Goldtooth, one of his, you know, his sons, and continues the work that's going on there, the Keep It in the Ground work. You know, they played a role early on in 1991 at the first People of Color Summit that I had mentioned before. And one of the first principles, there's 17 principles of environmental justice. And the first one, you know, that, you know, is dealing with the sacredness of Mother Earth. If we had that as our sort of mantra when we create policy or activities, and that was our focus, it would change the way that we do business in our country. It would change the way that our actions are guided if we made sure that the sacredness of Mother Earth was what we were focused on.
We are expecting more crackdowns on environmental protests over the next couple of years. There have been a lot of articles about the criminalization of these protests. Final thoughts from you on that. And we have a couple emails from listeners who say, you know, short of electing a new Congress in 2018 and a new president in 2020, what can the public do now to fight against the weakening or elimination of good federal programs like the environmental justice work of the EPA?
Yeah, well, you know, for me, you know, the civic process is super important. It was super important to Dr. King as well. So we have to stay engaged in that. We have to hold county, local, and state officials accountable, staying engaged with them. We have to make sure that our philanthropic family is funding the organizations that are those frontline communities and organizations who are on the ground. But we also have to remember something else that Dr. King shared with us. He said that we came to these shores on different ships, but we're all in the same boat now. If we realize that, when folks try and move forward on these types of actions of demonizing, of criminalizing individuals who are doing nothing more than standing up and trying to make sure that their communities are safe and healthy places and that we're living up to the ideals of the Constitution, then we just have to continue to put a high, you know, to highlight when folks are trying to move forward on this, when folks are trying to move forward on getting these types of things, you know, in legislation or policy, when folks try and roll back programs that have been put in place to keep us safer, then we have to hold them accountable. And then the other thing that we can do, and not enough folks talk about this, is for those businesses and industries that support negative actions inside and against communities, then we have to look at boycotting those and making sure that our dollars are not being utilized by them. We have to move toward divestment and reinvestment also, and making sure that, you know, our, if we have financial portfolios, if we have stocks, that we are not supporting those types of entities that we may not even know that we may be supporting. If our pension funds are supporting these types of things, then we need to get engaged and make sure that there is a movement away from that. So we have power. We have power that we can make change happen and that we can hold people accountable.
For 24 years, Mustafa Ali worked for the Environmental Justice Group at the EPA. He helped found the EPA's Environmental Justice Office in 92. He resigned from his post last March after the White House announced plans to dismantle the program. He is now Senior VP of Climate, Environmental Justice, and Community Revitalization at the Hip Hop Caucus. Mustafa, thank you so much for joining us. And if you're ever in the Bay Area, we'd love to have you in studio.
Well, thank you so much. It was a blessing to be with you and everyone. I hope you're out doing your day of service, but I hope you'll move past just one day of service to making sure that you are connected about the change that needs to happen on a day-to-day basis.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you. Coming up tomorrow on Your Call, we'll be joined by Daniel Ellsberg. He'll be talking about the Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. And if you get a chance tonight, be sure to watch the documentary about him, The Most Dangerous Man in America. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.